Reboot it, all said. Pardon? Switch it off and on again. Huh. He watched as she did that, his shoulder touching hers now. And finally she was saying, Well, what do you know? She looked at him. I should be buying you a drink. Sure. Her name was Louise. She was 35 and a little maudlin, but her mood lifted as they talked. In a land of holidaying nurses, school teachers and hairdressers, she was an anthropology postgrad, taking a break from fieldwork. Now she was coming to the end of her week at a Nusa Dua resort and was starved for company. You know who stays at those places? Teenage drunks too stupid to live and married couples who want to be waited on by native people while their kids go crazy. So she'd taken a taxi to Kuta Beach. More young drunks and middle-aged couples, thought all. And me. Her knees bumped against his under the table. Once or twice, their hands touched. It was nice. Then they were dining at a table a few meters away from Fanning's. The day had been hot and humid. The evening was mild and humid, punctuated by a quick, fierce tropical downpour that drew a curtain over the sunset and freshened the air briefly, before the odors of cooked spices, garbage and piss drifted in on the tails of it. They talked and dined, and all, occasionally scratching the new beard, watched Fanning. It's not like I'm huge or anything, Louise said at one point. But when I'm with them, I feel huge, you know? All nodded. Self-conscious, she said. On account of Indonesian people are so petite. I understand. He understood that she was lonely. So was he. He understood that she needed to vent a little. Well, so did he. That's why he was here. Like, if I go out on one of the boats or help with the fish processing or just sit and have a meal with them, and they're always offering me food, I'm getting so fat, I feel like some great lumbering water buffalo. Take it from me, all said. You're not. Tall, yes, with those capable hands and broad feet. Hair bleached and flesh dusky from months of studying Sumatran fisher folk on land and sea. But certainly no water buffalo. More slender than solid. Then she was eyeing him, shrewd despite the wine she'd drunk. Alan, you're not going to start talking about your wife and kids, are you? He could talk at length about them, but rarely felt the need. He smiled, shook his head. When do you return to the village? He wondered if the question was a misstep. It raised unspoken questions. Louise gazed at him levelly and said, Tomorrow afternoon? He looked away. He'd not checked on Fanning for a while. Fanning was still there. Returning to Louise, he said, Are you examining relationships, structures, men's work, women's work? She winced, and it came out haltingly. How she'd come to Indonesia intending to study the fisher boys in the Straits of Malacca. Virtual slave laborers working far from shore on the rickety, unlicensed fishing platforms known as Jermals. She'd had it all mapped out. A year and a half of fieldwork and archival research, 2 or 3 years of writing, resulting in a stunning PhD and a powerful book, until she was chased off by fisheries inspectors and Navy officials in the pay of Jermal owners. But by then she was ready to quit anyway. Boys as young as 12 working up to 23 hours a day, she told all. For months at a time. Paid a pittance, if they're paid at all. Crap food, back-breaking work. No toilets, no beds, no first aid. Regular beatings, fierce storms. Some of them drown. No one cares. Broke my heart. The acts of talking, unburdening, had loosened some of her tightness. She grew rueful and comic, grinned at him, watched her fingers on his forearm. All risked a glance. Fanning was still there. Then Louise was resting her chin in her palms and eyeing all. Enough about me. Tell me about you. Not quite so tipsy now. Warm, but he could see her thinking. Solitary, middle-aged Australian male on holiday in Bali. Sleazebag? She would gather her things in a moment and call it a night. All didn't want that. She was cover. And he liked her. Putting on a non-sleazy face, he said, I work for the Volcanic Ash Advisory Center, and gestured at the air. Clear this evening, but who knew what tomorrow would bring? The ash cloud from Mount Raung on East Java could close the airport at any time. Louise relaxed. Working holiday. Something like that. I wish you could wave a magic wand. When I'm not sitting around a village feeling fat, I'm coughing my lungs up. You get the ash down there? She shook her head. Smoke from the jungle fires. Then I come to Bali and strike ash clouds. Tell me about it, said Orr, wondering if his flight out would get cancelled. He couldn't afford to be stuck here. He looked over the balcony railing at the darkening sand and sea of Kuta Bay. The eastern tip of Java, a distant, smeary silhouette through the ash-filtered sunset. A Balinese family walked by, but mostly the beach strollers were Westerners. An obese man lay flat on a low table on the sand, enduring the last massage of the evening. Now and then one leg spasmed in protest. The odors of the day intensified. Perfumed tropical plants, wok oil, beer, deodorant, cigarettes. All felt Louise's warm hands around his. What does the job entail? Christ, if all knew. Monitoring. That probably covered it. Their meals arrived. A green curry for all, salad for Louise. She picked at it and eyed all's dish. Have some, he urged. She was torn. I have to be careful. Can I say something? Uh-oh. What? I think you look lovely. I'd never get tired of looking at you. She blinked and took her hand away. Objectification is a key theme in my line of work. Whose gaze? Can we be neutral? Can we know the other? Can we, should we, avoid objectifying and representing the other in our own terms, etc.? But then she grinned, as if she wouldn't dream of objectifying him as an old sleazebag. But thank you. Then she gave him a look. Crunch time. Tomorrow I have to return to the village, and you have to go watch clouds. So can we pretend we're lovers on holiday? All touched her taut forearm. Sure. But he needed to know Fanning's movements. His tension showed in his face. Louise looked away. I mean, if you don't want to... All was saved by Fanning himself saying to his friends, Sorry guys, no clubbing. I need a sleep in. As they say in the classics, All's hand encircled Louise's wrist lightly. Your place or mine? She took him to the Sanur Paradise Lagoon, a resort east of Kuta. Certainly a step up from my crappy hotel, All said. A collection of small villas set among swimming pools and coconut and bamboo groves, with further pools and restaurants overlooking the beach and out to Lombongan and Panida Islands. Expensive, but Louise had been determined to treat herself, and All found himself led in soft moonlight along a path and up steps and through a door to a vast suite. Bedroom, sitting room, bathroom, a balcony brushed by palm tree fronds, and overlooking yet another pool, glowing blue. I see what you mean by treating yourself. It's an ongoing process, Louise said, beginning with his top shirt button. Then the shirt was off, and she trailed her fingers over his chest, shoulders, and back. What's this scar from? A nasty slash from the bottom of his ribcage to his navel. I was walking along, minding my own business, and came across this street gang robbing an old woman. After I'd saved her, they turned on me. What happened? They killed me, damn it. What, and now you've been reincarnated as an environment protection bureaucrat? She looked up at him trustingly, still stroking his skin. All wondered if he'd see her again. Unlikely. If he did, sooner or later, he'd have to say he was a cop. He'd have to be truthful and tell her he'd been stabbed by a kid high on meth a few days after graduating from the academy. Or maybe she'd learn about him sooner than that. Maybe Indonesian or Australian federal police officers would track her down and grill her about the bearded man she'd spent a night with. He said, "It happened when I was a kid. I got cut by a nail when I was climbing a fence." She kissed it better. "If I'd known I'd be performing cunnilingus," he said later, not feeling entirely original, "I'd have shaved more closely." But some things proved to be universal. Louise cuffed his ginger head and told him to get on with it. He got on with it and woke at 5 a.m. to find a smooth thigh pressed against him. He stared at the ceiling and experienced a liberating sense of thankfulness. He hadn't felt wanted or attractive to someone for a long time. Finally, he stirred, showered, dressed, scribbled his Melbourne landline number on a sheet of resort notepaper, along with a row of kisses, and let himself out. In no particular hurry, he strolled along the beach, the air hazy, warm, the sand almost unpeopled in the last hour of moonlight. Only ranks of empty deck chairs aimed at the sea. Yard servants were sweeping leaves, picking up palm fronds and tourist litter, clearing entrances. A decorative culture, he thought, passing a villa set back behind a low stone wall, amid palm trees and stone columns, vases, urns and figures from Hindu mythology. The stonework wore a patina of damp green moss, and a moist, oily heat was already seeping into the day. He took a laneway that led away from the beach, passing small houses behind walls. At the end, he came to streetlights, a strip of motorcycle repairers and stone carving businesses. Vehicles and noise now. Cars, a truck, a family of four rolling by, balanced on the spine of a tiny, sputtering Honda. A man on the other side of the road pissed against a wall, his back to all, and then a taxi appeared. All gave the name of the yoga retreat in Fanning's village. A repeat of yesterday, except that he was earlier. But just as he was ducking into the cover of the villa wall, the air was torn open with sound and he jumped in fright. The mosque, broadcasting the call to prayer from four loudspeakers on a high pole in the front yard. All had barely subsided back into the shade when Fanning emerged from the villa. An obese, determined figure in boxer shorts, carrying an axe. Certain he'd been spotted, all ran back to the far corner of the wall and down into a ditch, his heart hammering. Time went by. He risked a glance. Fanning was intent on the mosque. All watched him enter the grounds and make straight for the loudspeaker pole. With a waggle of his large buttocks, Fanning swung the axe high above his head, seemed to expand mightily, then brought down the blade in a savage, cleaving stroke. Sudden silence. Satisfied, Fanning strode back across the lane, through his gate, and into his house. Meanwhile, the imam had appeared. He frowned up at the speakers, spotted the severed cable, peered around helplessly. Police, electricians, thought all, cursing. And Fanning wide awake. He gave it half an hour, concealed in the trees above the villa, occasionally sipping from a water bottle, watching for the arrival of servants or visitors. Then, drawing on latex gloves, he moved at a crouch downhill, into Fanning's backyard, through the kitchen door. Austerely white, mangosteens and rambutans in a wooden bowl, polished wooden floors, a small glass-topped bamboo table. Finally, an archway to a sitting room, also stark and modern. A massive home theatre screen flickered, a game of soccer playing somewhere in the world, the sound off. A coffee table on a white rug, a chunky glass tumbler, an empty scotch bottle. The tropical fruit aside, Fanning might as well have been at home in Geelong. A flicker in the corner of All's eye. A gecko, halfway up the wall, utterly still now, as if playing a game of statues with him. At the far end of the hallway, Open glass doors led to a deck, shadowy under ferns and blowsy hanging baskets, where bamboo wind chimes sounded softly, licked by a hill breeze. The neighboring house, a rice paddy beyond it. A man wandered through in bare feet, carrying a sickle. All sensed a busy, populated landscape, even though he'd barely seen or heard anyone yet. He listened, and presently followed a rattly snore to a bedroom midway along the hallway. Fanning sprawled asleep in his boxer shorts, head down, his backside aimed at the ceiling. Between the toes, all decided. He removed the syringe from his pocket, filled the barrow with the succinylcholine, gave a tiny preparatory squirt, and went straight in. Plunger depressed, 10 mils, no messing about. Fanning jerked awake at the sudden pain and thrashed around onto his back. He stared wild-eyed at all, then reared up at him with a roar. All stepped back. He said, "Intravenous would have been quicker, but I didn't want to fight around trying to find a vein." Fanning wavered. He grunted, spasmed, flopped onto his back. "Even so, it's quick acting," All said. He twinkled at Fanning. "It's called sucks. Appropriate, right? It mimics a heart attack." He leaned into the heavy, panicked face. "What's that? You want to know why?" "Your daughter, asshole. Your wife." A last faint flicker in Fanning's eyes. A cessation of panic. An accommodation with fate. All checked again for cleaners and gardeners, then left the house by the back door. From the trees on the upper slope, he could see into the grounds of the mosque. The imam had called the police. Three faces stared across at the villa. Soon they would make a decision and knock on Fanning's door. He slipped across the hillside and into a paddy field, and was skirting around it when he almost stepped on a woman. She was young, blonde, with braided hair, tie-dyed skirt and top, bangles, beads, rings, piercings, tats, an amalgam of 1960s hippie and contemporary hipster, and he had no idea where she'd sprung from. Seated in the lotus position, her face tilted in communion with the rising sun, she didn't stir when All muttered, "Sorry," and hurried on. Potential witness, he thought, with a twist of panic. He walked head down along the narrow earthen banks between paddy ponds thick with new rice shoots, making for the coast road below. Then he left the paddy behind and found himself in a familiar urbanscape of small houses behind crumbling walls, lean dogs, and popping Honda motorbikes. A breeze wrapped a blue supermarket bag around his ankles. But that was the street. Look inside someone's yard and you'd not see a scrap of paper or plastic. He reached the main road. Early commercial traffic snarled by. Bikes, tiny vans and taxis, all tooting as if All might want to buy a ride. He was relieved to see two girls and a boy striding ahead of him. Maple leaf flags stitched to their packs, their legs long and tanned. He felt old and weary, and trudged along behind them in the mounting exhaust gases until he reached a bus stop outside a motor repair business. Engine parts, 5-liter oil cans, a faded Shell sign on the back wall. The backpackers kept walking, but All joined the people waiting for a bus. A couple of women in sarongs, others in knee-length office skirts, a handful of schoolgirls. Feeling absurdly large as he stood among them, All thought of Louise, her warm lips kissing his scars. One of the women spoke sharply, shaking her fist at an old man astride a tiny Honda scooter. He was holding aloft a pair of goldfish in a clear Ziploc bag filled with water, urging the schoolgirls to buy. They were entranced. Another woman intervened, rebuking the girls this time, who withdrew, heads down, stifling giggles. Finally, the old man gave up, stowed the goldfish into a pannier, and rode away, merging with the restless traffic. And to All's relief, the Canadian backpackers returned. The bus arrived, and everyone trooped on. He was no longer a memorable lone Westerner in the vicinity of a vandalized mosque and a suspicious death. All, riding a bus, lulled into sleepiness, dreaming of Fanning's flabbiness. Louise making love with a kind of welcome relief. Bells tinkling on the hippie girl's wrists. Realizing as the bells dragged him awake that it was his phone ringing. An Australian number. His, in fact. His landline in Melbourne, where the time was now mid-morning. Dad, where are you? He had told his daughter he'd be in Port Fairy for a few days, an old hit-and-run rumoured to be a murder. Still away, he said. Okay, look, I know it's too soon, but this friend of mine and her boyfriend were house-sitting, and the owners came back unexpectedly, and can they doss down with us for a while? All felt sad and relieved and half-mad. Around him, the other passengers swayed, and scratchy music leaked from the speaker above the driver's head. He breathed in and out, deep breaths. Of course, sweetheart. They can move in tomorrow. Not sure I'll get back by then, all said, thinking of the volcanic ash. The bus stopped. An old woman boarded with a rooster in a bamboo cage. The bus started again, trundling on. All left the bus in Kuta Beach and took a taxi across to his hotel, where he checked out, paying cash, and walked to the main terminal. The airport was in turmoil. All Virgin and Jetstar flights cancelled. Ash cloud event, said the website. The cloud hovered between Denpasar and northern Australia. The skies to the north and west were clearer, but every Singapore and Kuala Lumpur flight was full. A waiting game now, all thought. The place teemed with stranded passengers. So he slumped on the floor next to a couple of kids in surf gear. His back, slouched against the wall, belied body and mind, which seemed to thrum. Although depleted of energy, he was tight as a bowstring, an edginess running through him. Not fear, he thought, or guilt, or dismay. He couldn't get his head around what it was. Who he was. Most of the killers he'd arrested in his long life had been men, and most had simply stuffed up in some way. He eyed the male passengers and airport staff now, young and old and in between, grumpy and harried and bored, tired and alert and dozing and canoodling, maimed, unblemished. Seeing a tourist with his arm in a sling, all thought of Claire Pascal's hacked about forearm, and he touched his stomach unconsciously, the thin worm of stitched flesh so recently kissed by a beautiful woman. Scarred by the job. He thought, what about the scars that can't be seen? A little Chinese girl was watching him. She stood hedged between the knees of her parents, who were intent on their phones. It often happened that all locked eyes with a child, in a crowd of people. A solemn, wordless communication would pass between them, unwitnessed by the throng. Now he did what he always did. Pulled on one earlobe to release his tongue tip, pulled on the other to retract it. Would she duck her head? Send the trick back to him. He waited. She continued to stare. All looked away, not discomforted, but wondering if the child had the savant eyes to see who he'd become and who he'd been. A man who'd plodded along, doing his best, righting a few wrongs. Then suddenly righted two big ones. Stumbling in, initially. Becoming decisive. Whether he was a better man, or one more resolute now, toned by recent sex and murder, all didn't know. But the energy was there in him, and he stood. Waved to the child, who waved back with a transformative beam, and did business at one ticket counter after another, spending the last of his savings. Soon he was on the way home. It took a day and a half. His route across the Pacific a series of oblique advances north, east, and south. Coming home the back way. But coming home. The end.
You've been listening to Under the Cold Bright Lights by Gary Disher. Narrated by Douglas Hansel. Published by Wave Sound Audiobooks, an imprint of W.F. Howes Limited. This work is copyrighted 2017, Gary Disher. This recording is copyrighted 2018, W.F. Howes Limited.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.